Welcome to the Peak Prosperity Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Taggart. Here at peakprosperity.com, we focus on practical and actionable knowledge for building a better future. A big part of that mission is identifying new models that offer better, more economically and environmentally sustainable solutions. One of the best models we've encountered is the regenerative, intensive no-till approach to farming being pioneered by Paul and Elizabeth Kaiser at Singing Frogs Farm in Sebastopol, California. The yield they get from the earth, while building new layers of rich topsoil in the process, is truly astounding. Our earlier podcast with the Kaisers back in 2016 remains one of our most popular and listened to episodes of all time, and they were a hugely appreciated part of our last annual Peak Prosperity Seminar, delivering a science-rich and truly inspiring presentation on their growing process, followed by a private walking tour of their farming operations. Well, we've got Paul and Elizabeth back with us this week to talk about what's happening at their farm now, and expand on the theme that they're presenting these days, resilience in farming, something that's near and dear to the Peak Prosperity audience. So without further ado, we're sitting down around the table in my kitchen as we did last time. Paul and Elizabeth, it's great to have you guys back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Adam, it's great to be here and to be chatting with all of you.
Great. Well, as I mentioned earlier, our first podcast with you guys was one of the absolute most popular we've ever done. I still get people almost every week or two pinging me about it and how much it inspired them and really opened their eyes to what's possible with farming. For the few people listening here that perhaps didn't listen to that earlier podcast, if you're one of those people, if you like this one, go back and listen to that one as well. We'll have a link to it at the bottom of this podcast. But can you just give us a brief summary for, you know, the newbie in terms of the operations at Singing Frog Farms? I'm going to hit just a couple of highlights, and you can expand on them, correct them, whatever. I know when we talked last time, you mentioned that your farm has over 4 feet of fertile topsoil versus most farms here in Northern California, which have less than one. You don't till or disc. You water it less than other farms, yet your productivity is much more than many other organic farms. I've read you get something like 5 to 7 harvests a year versus the standard 1 to 2 that a lot of farms get. Probably most impressively, last time we talked, you explained how you're grossing over $100,000 per acre in revenue, which not only dwarfs other farms, but out here in Sonoma County, there's a ton of vineyards, and we've been losing farmland to vineyards forever because it's a lot more profitable to grow wine grapes than other types of produce. But you're turning that model on its head. Is all this true? Whatever else folks need to know about your operations, just let us hear it.
Adam, that was a great recap. I almost don't have to say anything. let me just give a little bit of background of who we are and where we are.
Fantastic.
Yes, we are in Sonoma County. So for those of you who aren't local, to us here, we're about an hour and a half north of the Golden Gate Bridge of San Francisco. Our property is 8 acres, and about 3 acres of that is that intensive veg. The rest is our ponds, our home, as well as ecology that we have built up. We do sell about 40% of our produce to our CSA and about 50% to our farmers market customers, and then a little bit around the edges to some local restaurants. So we're really proud that about 97% of our produce stays within 15 miles of the farm.
And our CSA just means Community Supported Agriculture. So we have about 120 families who are members of the farm, and they get a weekly box year round.
Yes. And year round is really, really important to us. So our CSA goes weekly through the main season and then every other week in the winter. And we're in a place where it's challenging to grow in the winter. We had a pretty good frost this morning, but we all eat year round. And so we find that it's very important to do so. And also, not only does it keep us fed, but it keeps our customers going year round. And so it really adds to the resiliency of our farm economically growing year round.
And just to re-solidify sort of our farming practice, we are very much a no-till operation, and this is non-mechanized no-till. So this is all hand labor. There is no turning or moving of the soil, and we can rotate crops through within an hour or so once we harvest a crop and clear the bed, prep the soil, and continue with the next crop. So there's no disturbance of the soil. So it's not so much that we have 4 feet of topsoil, it's that we've built up the organic matter and the biology in our soil in the top 4 feet so that we have now 400 or 500% more biology and organic matter than we used to have. So in fact, through our intensive no-till agroecological farming practices, the more we farm our soil, the better the soil gets.
Yeah, I love that about the model. That's why I referred to it at the beginning as regenerative. And you are actually adding layers of topsoil over time, right?
Sure, definitely. But we're also, if you're a good farmer, and we tend to be good farmers, one of your jobs is to extract as much as you can from your land.
Right.
So in some regards, you're constantly harvesting and removing carbon and water and other nutrients from your soil. So while we're also adding and building up topsoil and harvesting and removing a lot of it, really the key is what's happening in the soil.
Within the soil itself, yeah.
And so rather than building up, we're really just creating more life within our soil, which really creates more resiliency.
Okay.
Not to mention more nutrient density.
Well, I want to dig into that in just a minute. Yep. But for again, for folks that that didn't listen to the previous podcast, I'm going to try really quickly to differentiate no-till versus sort of traditional farming practices, and then you just jump in and correct everything I said that was wrong. But sort of traditional farm, they till, which means they you basically churn up the top layer of the soil. Lots of issues around that. One, it's very destructive to the life that's in the soil. Two, it dries out the soil. A lot of the key nutrients dry out and aerosolize away.
Yep.
Other traditional farming practices is you know, because they're not as regenerative, they're having to bring in lots of outside inputs to the soil. You know, key fertilizers, you know, nitrogen, potassium, that type of stuff. Where in your scenario, what you're doing, you are bringing some inputs in, and that's largely in the form of compost,
right?
Which is, you know, very naturally generated. Mm-hmm. But what you do is you grow a crop, you do not till it. I know there's a lot of complementarity of how you're growing certain plants with others to create shades and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes time to harvest, you basically harvest the plant above the root bowl. You leave the roots in the soil. You take out the plant that you're harvesting. You then, that same day, lay a fresh layer of compost on the soil. You're covering mm-hmm. that old root system that's going to decompose and refertilize the soil mm-hmm. as it decomposes.
Yep.
You're then going to plant another crop same day
yep.
In that new layer of topsoil that you just laid down. And this is one of the ways in which you are keeping the nutrients in the soil itself, but you're also able to go from one crop to the next. So I know one of the things you guys said that's really important for there always to be something photosynthesizing
right.
on the soil, right?
Yep.
And because you're putting in one crop right after the other, you're able to do multiple crops a year, and economically that allows you to sell more product.
Absolutely. And I'd like to talk more about photosynthesis, but first of all, I just want to recognize it's challenging to just share this verbally with people. And if you've not been to our farm or seen photos of our farm, I highly recommend just going, looking at some photos on our website, Instagram, Facebook, anywhere you can, so you can actually visualize what we're talking about right now,
Great.
If that makes sense.
And I'll put some links in the write-up too,
oh,
so
perfect.
It'll be easy for folks to do that.
Yeah, but photosynthesis, I mean, that's really what we want to capture, that sunlight that is constantly going on so that the plants are capturing that, taking the carbon out of the atmosphere from the CO2, creating glucose, resynthesizing that into all sorts of other carbon-based products, using that for their own growth and development partially, but also then pushing out many of those sugars and other carbon-based products into the soil to feed the microbiology in that soil. First, the bacteria and the fungi that are right around the root hairs, and then from there, the entire soil food web. So this is really the reason why we want to focus on having green living plants in the ground as often as possible, a diversity of green living plants. So you're not growing, chard followed by chard, followed by chard, followed by chard, but, one crop and then the next, and often different crops mixed in the same bed at the same time. So you've got different things going in there, feeding that life in the soil.
And so if you have your crop plants becoming these photosynthetic capacitors that take in the free sunlight and free atmospheric carbon and are pushing out half of what they make into the soil to feed the biology, that's why it's so critical when the harvest is done and you're ready to remove that crop, most farms would plow it under or till it under or disc it under with mechanical means, and that wipes out all that biology. So if you think about those root exudates being pushed out into the soil to feed the biology, there's this enormous rhizosphere of healthy biology interacting with those roots of the crop. And the very act of tillage wipes it out, completely wipes it out. Whereas if you can cut off that crop at the soil level, like you mentioned, and all of the above ground crop biomass goes to the compost pile to come back later as finished compost, but the entire below ground biology of the root structure and the rhizosphere is intact and untouched, and you plant in the very next crop a couple hours later, you always have photosynthetic capture over the soil. You've always got root exudates happening, so the biology in the soil is undisturbed. And it's amazing what really, truly healthy soil biology can do for vegetable plants.
All right, well, let's use that as the segue then into this larger topic of farming resilience. Because I know it's something that that you guys have actually been actively presenting on across the country, and I do want to give you guys the kudos that's due. No-till farming, I think, is beginning to become kind of at the edges of awareness in farming as a potentially superior model. Let's say
actually some of these soil management principles we've known since the 30s.
Yeah, exactly.
But people have had, this box of this is how farming has to be, and so they'll go and learn in academic settings of, here's soil science, but this is, how farming actually happens is different because that's the way that it's had to be.
Right. Well, it's so funny that it was called the Green Revolution, right? That happened back in the mid 20th century that, let farms boost all their crop yields by using all these fossil based inputs and whatnot. Of course, it's anything but green in terms of the philosophy behind it. But yes, to your point is that that's the established canon of how to farm.
Absolutely.
And we're having to rediscover, older practices that actually, when applied, a bit more scientifically today, it's kind of a back to the future way to get to a better model. And that's very consistent with a lot of the different forms of resilience we talk about, peak prosperity. We say, a lot of the things that we advise people do in terms of the behavior change in their lives is things that their great grandparents would recognize.
Right.
We've just culturally lost them over the past couple of decades. It sounds like it's very similar in farming. But I do want to give you guys kudos that, you've been very early on pioneering this no-till farming practice, not only, doing it yourself and proving what's possible, but actually being out there as educators. So it's wonderful to have a chance to talk directly with you guys, with our audience about this. So resilience in farming, I know there's several different components that are important to you. I'm just going to quickly mention them and then we can dial through them in whatever pace we want. But soil biology, which I think we were just getting into, and I'd love to continue that. And you contrast that versus chemistry, and I'd love to have you kind of expound on why you differentiate biology versus chemistry when it comes to farming. Basically, income resiliency, innovation and research, so what's going on in the science right now, ecological resilience, and we'll talk about this in a moment, but I think that the way I'm thinking about that is it's not so much the soil itself, that's the biology part, the ecology is what's happening all around the soil. And then farmer self-care, which I think is really
resilient
interesting.
Farmers.
Yeah, resilient farmers. So diving into this, why don't we start on the biology side of things? You talked a bit about what's happening, under the soil level, or under the ground level in the soil. Why don't we talk about some of that science? I know when you were talking at the Peak Prosperity Seminar this past April, you had a lot of slides and you talked about, the fact that there's a whole universe down there going on that I think most people are just completely unaware of.
Good word choice. I was going to bring up our galaxy first.
Okay.
Our solar system, I should say. It's ironic that we have spent the past 70 or 80 years so heavily focused on the chemistry of soil and trying to feed it chemically to get back a return from our harvest. Mm-hmm. If you think about our solar system, all the planets that we have, what makes the Earth unique? All planets have chemistry. Earth is the only one that has biology. We don't farm on Mars, but Mars has plenty of chemistry going on. It's the biology that makes things unique, and we have forgotten that. Because chemistry from World War I and World War II, we had lots of leftover chemicals, we had to find a place to use them. So I think coming back to the roots of biology as the basis of life on our planet Earth is so critical to helping create life in terms of crops and plants and nutrient density and our own health. And one of the reasons why it's so important to focus on the biology we have found as farmers is that, honestly, if you think about farming, we all, whether you're a farmer or not, we all can name the typical problems farmers face. It's weeds and pests and diseases are typical farmers' problems, period. And topsoil management and erosion. Well, it's amazing that we used to have all those same problems, weeds, pests, diseases, and erosion. until we began to build up our soil organic matter, sequester atmospheric carbon into the soil, and build up soil biology. And I don't mean build it up a little bit, like a 10% increase or 20% increase. I'm talking that 400% increase in soil health. And that changed the game. We don't have pests. We don't have weeds. We don't have diseases, viruses, pathogens. Our biggest challenges are simply just managing people and selling food. So the real crux of what we all know to be farming is based in a system of degraded soil that causes so many of those problems.
Oh, that's great. So let's dig into that for a bit, because essentially what you're saying is by feeding the biology of the soil, it's just like feeding your immune system in many ways, right? Bringing your immune system up to a healthy state. So what's really going on down there? Like, what are the things that you're actually feeding and nurturing down there? I know you've talked a lot about mycelia and whatnot, and it's a novel term for folks. It's an area that they don't really know much about. And for a lot of people that
honestly
are talking about fungi, but
go
ahead.
A lot of people don't know a lot, but, and we've had soil biologists come out, microbiologists come out, and I'm like, look at the soil test and tell me what, it's too complex. And I focus on nematodes specifically under oak groves. Can't you infer something?
Yeah. We've only identified maybe 4% of the total soil biology, and we haven't even named that 4%. We've only just identified that it exists. So it's massively complicated.
But
however,
going back to that, especially the fungal capacity in the soil, we know that it is not only bringing water in, it is helping bring in nutrients. And there's many, many different signatures going back and forth between the plants through their roots, through their exudates, and the microbiology, be it the bacteria or be it the fungi, in terms of, I need this nutrient, and pulling it out of the minerals in the soil, be that a heavy clay or, you know, a sandy loam, whatever you have, be it a high pH or a low pH. And the biology is able to help the plants do that. They're even doing communications between plants. There was an interesting study that looked at bean plants in a field, and when one end of the field was attacked by a certain pest, the other end started exuding a chemical that
repelled
that pest. Thank you very much.
Wow.
And so they took it into the lab and they said, well, let's, you know, isolate for air transfer, soil transfer, without biology, soil transfer with biology, water transfer. And what they found, it was the mycelium that were connecting and basically acting as a internet
the plants. A soil-based internet. That's so cool.
I mean, so that's just one tiny example. And if that's happening, there is a lot more communication out there. There's new research in forests and trees, looking at how trees are communicating with each other. And if there's an old tree and a young tree and they're competitors, it might actually be a negative communication where they're, you know, pulling nutrients away from that younger tree, or maybe they're helping that tree. It's really interesting, nascent science that's happening.
But I think a lot of what we've really learned from it all is that world of soil biology is so complicated, and yet it mirrors our own human digestive system.
Sometimes, yes. And we are just learning about our digestive system, how it's working as our immune system sometimes, how it's helping our mental health and so many other things. So I think that's an example. And they are just starting to look at, you know, the nutrition in our vegetables. And how that is linked with the biology in the soil. And you can look at many studies over many, many years have looked at nutritional density of not only our vegetables, but also our grain and our meat in the United States, and how it's declined, so that these days they have to recommend, you know, you have many, many servings of vegetables. Well, our grandparents maybe didn't have to have that many servings because their vegetables were far more nutrient dense.
Yeah.
And there's a direct link, it seems. We're just lacking the science between soil organic matter and soil biology and nutrition. Given everything else we just mentioned here, we don't have the exact 1 + 2 + 3s, but we're getting the gist of what's happening there. You build up your soil, you support the biology in the soil, you make sure that you don't use any biocides or other fossil fuel-based fertilizers that hurt that biology. Support it in every way you can, and you will grow better, like Paul said, with fewer pests, fewer weeds, but you'll also grow more nutrient-dense food, and that's powerful.
Well, I love all that, and I love the analogy of the gut biome, you know, versus the soil biome. I mean, it just makes a lot of sense that they operate very similarly. And what I love about you just saying there, Elizabeth, is I think anybody listening to this, you know, kind of intuitively knows the correctness of what you're saying, because everybody's had a tomato from a big box grocery store. And I hope everybody's had the chance to eat a tomato freshly picked from, you know, their own garden or the garden of a friend. And they just don't compare.
Nope.
Right? I mean, you can literally see and taste the difference. So no surprise at all that you raise a plant in a soil with a healthy biome. It's going to have a lot more nutrients and taste a lot better too.
Mm-hmm. And I'd actually like to bring this back to resiliency in terms of the climate also, because these days we have a climate that is quite unstable, and there's many things happening. And as we want to farm into the future, where we have a growing population we need to provide for, we need to make sure that our farms are resilient. And what I just want to give a couple of examples of climactic challenges that we've had on our farm. This might not be what all farms have, but I think it gives a good example. I mean, here in Sonoma County, we've got floods, we've got fires, and where we are in our low valley bottoms, we have frosts and freezes. So in terms of the floods, about a fourth of our fields actually will go underwater every winter. And that's just from the backing up of the Atascadero Creek that is in our valley bottom. And for many farmers, and actually some of our local farmers as well, when you have that flood water come in, it can lock up the soil. If you don't have good soil structure through the biology and the soil organic matter, there's no air left in there, and the plants can't breathe, and the plants can't get their nutrients. And so we've seen instances where, you know, other farmers have even said, oh, there was a flash flood and we had 10 inches of rain, and they had complete loss in their fields because all their plants were drowning. And we are going, wait, we're not having anything. You know, it's fine, because that soil, that resilient soil, is able to take the rain and, you know, instead of running it off and soaking and creating this anaerobic mess, actually infiltrating down and holding that water.
While still maintaining air spaces.
Right.
So the plants don't get waterlogged, they don't get drowned. The soil actually takes in the moisture and holds it and recharges the aquifer. And there's no erosion, there's no sediment loss, there's no nutrition loss, no nutrient loss.
Absolutely.
That's great. So, and, you know, this again parallels a message we talk about at Peak Prosperity, where we focus on wetlands versus areas that have replaced their wetlands with culverts that just rush out to the sea, right? And it's very similar to what you're talking about, right? I mean, those wetlands are a natural sponge. They're a way to keep the local ecosystem around when there's too much water, right? And that's essentially what you're creating in your farm, and obviously your neighbors who haven't built up the same type of soil you have, they're the culverts.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, the floods for us are mostly a problem in that we have to make sure that those areas don't have crops coming out during the seasons when we're going to have floods, because I can't harvest a crop after the flood is in there. But in terms of the soil really helps us move through that with ease. Another one then is fires. So we had fires last year in Sonoma County that came as close as 11 miles to our farm. And then again this year, we had fires that were 120 miles away, but we had really intense smoke. And that impacted us last year. We had so much ash falling out of the sky because of the fires. Paul and I really had to sit down and say, is our food safe to send out? Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of questions in the community. Is the soil safe? Are there all sorts of toxins that have gone up there? Well, there have since been some community studies through our UC Extension that have actually shown that, well, first of all, our most major exposure was through breathing it. But then when the toxins, if there are any, enter the soil, then through rain, ash, and then the rain following it, your ways of mitigating that are going to be mycorrhizae fungi and other types of fungi. So when we were talking about remediation of areas, I don't know if you remember last year, it was inoculating areas with spores of different kinds of fungi. And so by having a biologically active soil, you are able to be resilient as well to some of those toxins that may come our way.
That's the number one way. That's the number one strategy to mitigate that kind of environmental toxin. Wow. It's healthy soil biology.
So we're right back to that immune system analogy, yes. Right?
Yeah, right, exactly. And then the last thing being freezes.
Honestly, with more soil biology, more soil organic matter, we have a darker, richer colored soil. It looks like chocolate cake. Mm-hmm. And that's just a glorious sight to see. And by being this rich, dark chocolate cake, honestly, that's going to have a darker color, so it absorbs more solar gain in the day. It stays warmer at night. It releases that warmth. And so the plants do better against freeze and frost. And by having a darker colored soil that's warmer, that's better for soil biology. Soil biology will stay active longer into the fall and winter and become active again earlier in late winter and spring because the soil warms up more quickly, which keeps that biology active rather than hibernating.
That's so interesting. So that is really cool. Real quick before we move on too, I just wanted to, in the presentation that you gave at our last seminar, you had slides of different types of soil, some that had this sort of rich chocolate cake biology, like a lot of those probably came from your farm, but you had instances of soil that wasn't. It was very chalky or very hard dense clay or whatnot. Mm-hmm. But you then showed before and after pictures where the people who were on that soil then started adopting some of your no-till practices, and you could see the transition from what looked like almost unfarmable hardpan
right
to something you could just stick your fingers in. Right?
Absolutely.
Is that all accurate?
Absolutely, definitely. And you mentioned one of our biggest off-farm inputs might be compost. And I don't know if we mentioned it last time, but compost is, I think, a fantastic off-farm input that we should be doing more of.
Agreed.
Because honestly, if we don't recycle food waste, it creates greenhouse gas emissions. So we should be recycling food waste far more than we should be recycling steel, glass, and plastic. They don't have a negative externality. But food waste does have a negative externality if it's not recycled. So bringing it back onto the farm, we're in the business of exporting nutrients off the farm. And if we can bring that nutrient cycle back onto our farm, it's just closing the loop. So there's no spillage and leakage and loss of nutrients out into the environment, but rather that nutrient just cycles from the farm to the community, to the composter, back to the farm.
And that's what I love about the whole resilience theme here, because what percentage of food is thrown away?
52% of our landfills is food or something like that.
Exactly. A tremendous amount. So this is a way for the community to become more resilient,
yes,
where you're taking that rather than going to a landfill and creating greenhouse gases and just being pure waste. It's going back into the local farming production.
Right.
Right.
And another mention, when we put down a layer of compost between crops, it isn't every time. There are plenty of crops we'll just keep going crop after crop without any compost put down. And when we do put the compost on, it's really only about a half inch. So it isn't like adding a whole new layer of topsoil. It's just a small sprinkling. And we've also looked at our total organic matter increase over the past 10 years and the biology in the soil. And we've looked at how much of that probably came from the compost application versus being no-till and intensive and managing soil for soil's sake. And we found that probably only a quarter of our increases in organic matter and biology came from the application of compost. Far greater percentage of it, 3/4 of it, came from, honestly, taking care of our soil. Not tilling, being intensive, maximizing photosynthetic capture and root exudation, etc.
All right. So we've just hit, I think, the biology part of
which
your resilient farming. Let's transition now into income.
Absolutely.
So we talked earlier about, obviously one way to be more resilient with income is to make a lot more money per acre farm, which you guys seem to be doing.
Right. So honestly, that's the big one. And for us, that does mean, having one crop come out and the next crop come in, so that each bed on our farm has between 3 to 8 economic crops per year. And then often 2 crops at the same time. Now, we can't do that in the winter and the early spring, but for, late spring through late summer, we can definitely do that, where we have 100% cover of, say, a cauliflower plus another 70% cover of another crop, like a lettuce or something like that. That serves lots of different. But also just in being resilient, you want to have a lot of different enterprises, especially in something like farming, where weather can have such a huge impact. Mm-hmm. And you can have, all your brassicas go bad over the spring or something like that. And one thing that I found is over the past several years, our income has been very flat. And I see that as a good thing because we're not increasing our production. We've got a good methodology and so forth. But during that time, I can tell you we had, you know, huge problems this spring with X and huge problems this fall with Y. But how many different varieties do we grow on our farm? We grow almost 100 different varieties. So when, you know, the lettuce crops are doing bad, you know, this is doing well. And so it's resilience through basically stacking functions and stacking different enterprises, some, most of which are in the field, but honestly, some of which aren't. So one of our more recent enterprises has been doing shoot production in our greenhouses in the winter. So that gives a really lovely high quality and high value crop to our CSA and our farmers markets in the winter when it's more challenging outside because of fewer hours of daylight and cold weather.
That's great.
And then we're also on our farm doing education. We don't count that in the numbers of how much we're bringing in per acre, but that definitely helps, you know, with our family and everything else. And we need to take that into consideration.
So every season and every year we've had a variety of different challenges or losses here and there. But despite always having a different kind of crop loss and different challenges every single season, our overall revenue stream hasn't varied by even 1%.
Right.
Wow, that's impressive.
That's how stable it is, despite challenges that are always different and varied.
Right.
And that's resiliency.
I'll listen to a story of some farmers who are no-till who put a third of their, you know, crop into garlic for this year and they had a loss on their garlic. There goes a third of their income.
There's no resiliency there. Ouch. There's no stability because there are too many eggs in one basket.
Right, right. Well, what I love about this, again, another parallel with peak prosperity. So with financial capital, we talk about having multiple income streams, right? And in many ways, that's what you're saying, right? And you're not putting all your eggs in one basket. So you're highlighting the difference between a monocropping operation and I've never heard anyone really use this term, but a polycropping operation. And that's really what you guys are doing, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. The key, you know, thing I think that that kills most farmers, especially the monocroppers, is a crop gets popular one year. So everybody plants that the next year, right? And then the bottom falls out of that market, right? So, you know, to your guys' point, whether your Brussels sprouts didn't do well this year, either because of, you know, frost or because everybody planted Brussels sprouts this spring, you've got many, many other products that you're selling that are going to take up the slack.
Yep. Yeah. And so our markets also, I mean, you noticed I said that we're 40% CSA and 50% farmers market. There's a reason why it's that split. Mm-hmm. It works really well in terms of, you know, having your core people who they're there to support you throughout the year and you do your best and you do an awesome job. That didn't sound great, but, you know, you provide them sort of the meat and potatoes of what's coming off of the farm. And then your farmers market, you have much more flexibility. So it's lovely having different markets. And like I said before, also growing year round provides us a lot of resilience because, you know, when we were just a seasonal CSA, I can't tell you what that dance was like in early spring.
Oh,
that, yeah. I remember how great it was last year. Why don't you come on back and join us again versus just here's your quarterly bill, you know,
and
here's
people
your next
stay
bill.
With us.
Here's
for
your
years.
Next bill. Yep. So that works really well. And even though CSAs throughout the nation are declining, I actually have a wait list right now. So our CSA is rocking it. And also being year-round in terms of like the farmers markets and restaurants, for instance, our largest market come late January, there's about 4 vendors who sell fresh veg that's not storage crops or shoots like microgreens. Mm-hmm. And then you come,
mid-May, and those four farms are now 15 farms in mid-May. And then by mid-June, when season really begins, those 15 farms are now 48 farms doing fresh harvested veg. So we go from 4 farms in dead of winter to 48 farms in peak season. Well, the other part of what happens in peak season in summertime, school's out, people go on vacation, their own backyard gardens come into fruition. So buyers fall away. Just when all the farms come online,
Right. Everyone's
got a ton of food and no one's buying. But we've been there year round. So the customers who are still dedicated and still come every single week, they still come to our booth first, because we've been there 52 weeks a year for years, and they know that we are their grocery store, and they get all their food from us, and then they'll go find out what these new farmers might have for a dollar here and $2 there. It's a very different marketing strategy to be the grocery store for your customers year round.
that makes a ton of sense. And I'm sad to hear that nationally, it sounds like the CSAs are declining, you said. But I mean, you guys, again, are an outlier in terms of, your level of productivity, your diversity of product and all that stuff. And again, I'm hoping that, you know, more and more farmers, and hopefully some even listening to this podcast, are getting inspired by you and get into this more. But in addition to, you know, specifically what's going on at your farm, I just love the CSA model from a community resiliency standpoint.
Absolutely.
Right. You know, farmers, there's a lot of risk that they take on, and the ability to have dependable cash flow throughout the year allows you to, you know, make the investments you need to make at the right times during the season and whatnot. You're not living with the uncertainty, and you're not, you know, if there's a bad harvest for some of these other farms, they can get wiped out. You know, mm-hmm. September comes along, they didn't get the income they thought, and they're done.
Yep.
Whereas streaming that revenue out over the year, your risk of failure at any one point in time is a lot lower. And so exactly. That actually keeps the farming network in your community a lot stronger. So
I can tell you that I rely on the CSA year-round payments to help us pay our payroll in February and March.
Hard times of the year, but
yes.
To grow food. But we are still harvesting and growing food.
Oh, yeah, we are.
And it keeps things really even keel and balanced throughout the year.
It does.
It keeps that infrastructure in place so that it scales
absolutely.
Up when it needs to. Yeah.
So we don't have to rehire and retrain.
All right. So, yeah. Hooray, CSAs. All right. Let's switch to the ecology side right now.
Absolutely.
We have definitely talked a lot about the soil biology, which is the below ground ecology of our farming operation.
Absolutely.
There's also the above ground ecology part, which really for us includes a lot of the perennial plants that we bring in to mix with the annuals. And I think we talked about it a little bit in the last podcast, but briefly, your beneficial insects tend to have longer lifespans, and therefore they need a stable environment. And they can find stability in perennials, which are the bushes and trees that live year to year. So if we can really focus on above ground perennial bushes to create habitat for beneficial insects, then we started to introduce permanent pest control into our fields. There's a whole nother secondary aspect though to those same hedgerows, which would be rows or plots of 3 to 6 foot high bushes, perennial bushes throughout your annual vegetable fields. The other benefit to those hedgerows, honestly, is climatic stability. And it's amazing how much resilience hedgerows can offer vegetable fields. On the super hot summer days, it's cooler near the hedgerow. Really bitterly cold, frigid winter mornings and nights, it's a little bit warmer near the hedgerows.
You'll notice that those areas don't have frost.
Right.
Whereas 10 feet, you know, further away from the hedgerow does have frost.
And why is that? Is it air currents? Is it
generating? They're trapping air masses.
Okay.
They're trapping air masses. So on the winter times, they're definitely trapping warmer air amongst their branches and leaves, and allowing the warm air to trickle out into the nearby field areas. In the summertime, it's kind of the same idea of trapping cooler air in amongst their branches, plus they're transpiring and respiring, so a lot more moisture in that air, so it can help moderate the temperature spike. So you make a much more healthy, balanced temperature throughout the day and night, year-round, with hedgerows. And the other benefit is wind reduction. Honestly, you all know if you stand out in the middle of field in the afternoon and it's windy and full sun, you don't feel so hot. That's not the best place to hang out and have a conversation. Mm-hmm. If you want to have a conversation, you don't stand in the middle of a wide open field in the sun and wind for 2 hours. You go find a tree or even a fence or a truck or something to go lean against or stand near, and it makes you feel more protected, less exposed. Well, that wind is amazingly stressful on the plants and the soil biology. And we often forget the effects of constant sun and constant wind on the soil biology, not to mention the crop plants. So by having hedgerows that can reduce that wind stress on both the crop plants and the soil, you reduce not only the stress, you reduce the evapotranspiration and loss of water, and you overall make a better growing environment for the crop plants and that soil biology.
Wow. Okay. So for hedgerows, you said you've got about 3 acres that you're actually farming on.
Mm-hmm. And some of that includes a few hedgerows that are, you know,
parts of the fields and stuff like that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Intersecting the fields.
Okay. But you know, with those 3 acres, is it just hedgerows on the perimeters, or do you have them kind of going like lattice through? Or?
It is throughout.
Okay.
It is throughout. You cannot go more than 100 feet without coming across a hedgerow.
Okay.
So they are constantly throughout the fields in all different orientations, though they're primarily oriented as windbreaks from the main direction that our wind comes from. Yeah. But they're still throughout the fields everywhere.
And a lot of the studies have shown that your beneficial insects that are going to find their home in those dense woody perennials will go out up to 200 to 500 feet. But we've decided, you know what? They're going to forage closer to home rather than further than home.
Yeah.
So our rule has been about 100 feet from any one crop to a hedgerow.
Yep.
So this is a naive question, but what are some of the species of plant you have in a hedgerow?
There's actually a great nonprofit called pollinatorpartnership.org in San Francisco, and they actually have a online calculator where you can type in your zip code, your area code, zip code. Type in your zip code, and it will give you a list of all the native plants to your zip code that are pollinator friendly. And it'll break them up by annuals and perennials and bushes and trees and ground covers. But really, whatever is native in your area will be the most resilient, because it'll be adapted to your climate. It'll also be adapted to your beneficial insects and pollinators, or they'll be adapted to the plants. So here in Sonoma County, we use a lot of toyon and ceanothus and buckwheats and purple flowering asters and some dogwoods, that kind of stuff. Things that are native to our areas that have a high value for pollinators, as well as a high value for the beneficial insects in addition to pollinators.
And then we also like to mix in some that are fruit-bearing. So that might be a medicinal elderberry, it might be apple trees, it might be pear trees.
Or the fejo guavas. We also focus on some ground covers like clovers that are perennial, or perennial grasses like a deer grass. The clovers in our roadways tend to harbor millions or billions of beetles and spiders, which do phenomenal pest control for us. And then the deer grasses harbor lots of lady beetles or ladybugs that like to overwinter and hibernate there. And they do a wonderful job of aphid management for us. So all these different perennials can really provide the habitat you need for your pest control.
Wow. All right. Well, that's just so inspiring. And I'm sure too, for those that go on the tour at Singing Frog Farms, or Singing Frogs Farm, that you'll be able to point out in real time where all these things are. And if folks want to create some of these at home, they can get some inspiration and ideas for how to do it.
For sure. Definitely. And it's actually, just because we're on pests, it's nice to loop back to the soil biology, because people forget that soil biology, by increasing it by 400%, actually becomes one main system of pest control as well. Almost every natural farming pest out there has at least one life cycle stage in the soil. Usually the adults are feeding on the crop, then the adult drops into the soil, burrows down in, lays eggs, the eggs hatch, larvae crawl through the soil and come out, and then become adults to feed on the crop again. If you have healthy soil biology, those adults that drop into the soil are probably going to be devoured before they can ever lay the eggs. And if they lay the eggs, those eggs are never making it back to the surface again. So healthy biology really in the soil takes care of your pests as well.
Yeah, that's very cool. All right. So just looking at time here, I want to make sure we get through your other elements of resiliency here. Innovation and research.
You know, honestly, I would say that nobody can tell you how to farm. You need to figure out how to do it in your area, given your markets and so forth. And that really takes observation. And that's how we got where we are. And we are continually doing it. We're doing some trials on doing cover crops and growing plants through them. Cover crops versus, you know, occultation in the winter right now. And you need to do that in order to know, you know, what's the best way we can do this. And so,
and we're also
constantly being flexible and keeping an eye out is very important.
And we're definitely trialing just multi-crops. What kinds of things grow well together at the same time in the same bed space, and both for architectural or structural shapes, and also for nutrient extraction and nutrient exudation. So what crops grow very well together? And
can you give an example of a crop pair that works well together?
We've always loved the easiest one for us are the brassicas, like cauliflower and broccoli, with lettuces underneath. And the reason for that, we transplant both at the same time. That gives you better ground cover right away, so you have more photosynthetic capture and less exposed soil to the sun and the wind. And then as they grow, the lettuce gets ready to harvest just as the cauliflowers and broccolis begin to close canopy, which means the broccoli and cauliflower are giving just a little bit of light shade and light windbreak to the lettuce right near harvest, which makes the lettuce more tender, more flavorful, and just healthier all around. Meanwhile, that lettuce is suppressing weeds for the cauliflower and broccoli. It's also, because it's covering the soil, it tends to be creating higher levels of soil moisture and healthier soil biology from less soil exposure and more root exudation. So the lettuce is helping benefit the soil and suppress the weeds for the broccoli and cauliflower crops. So when the lettuce harvests, then the broccoli and cauliflower fill in entirely, and a month later you get the harvest from them, weed-free, using less water with healthier soil returns.
Yeah, it makes total sense. So it's basically, it's a process of ever hacking the garden and just trying to figure out what works best. And you know, in our framework, the eight forms of capital, we talk about knowledge capital, and it's really the marriage of, you know, kind of what you know, sort of the book knowledge, and what you know how to do, which is the experiential knowledge out there, right? And a lot of times something works great on paper or on the blackboard, but does not work dependably when you go try it in the real world. So, you know, developing what we call as mastery is really getting out there and marrying the two together and finding out what's going to work and what's going to work dependably, right? Yeah. So even though the principles of no-till make a ton of sense, if you go out and just, you know, magically apply them to your own specific garden or plot of land there, some elements might work great, some may not work great. And right. It's that tinkering is sort of what you're talking about. You've got to be observant, as you said, but you've also got to dedicate the time, right? You can't just plan to go from 0 to 100 in a single season.
Yes.
You're probably going to have to, you know, go through a couple of trial and error periods.
But that's why it's really critical that people understand the science behind this.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people come to us for the how do you do it?
The book knowledge.
Yeah, but if you don't understand the science of why things work, then you'll never have success just using our how in your context.
Right.
So it's so critical to understand the science behind it and then apply that. Because science is universal. That's global. But contextual factors will dictate how and when you use what kind of mulch and how and when you plant what kind of crop and all those other variables that are more selective to your context in your area.
Because they're not going to have the same topology as your farm. Right. They're not going to have the same climate.
Right.
And I would say what's really important is, you know, sort of the boiled down principles of soil management. And as an example, last January, we did a really fun talk with Gabe Brown from North Dakota, who does also very regenerative grain and cattle growing on 3,000 acres and has brought his soil organic matter from 1.9 to over 11%. And we went over these principles of soil management. And on 3 acres of veg in Northern California, this is how we're applying this principle. And on 3,000 acres in North Dakota, this is how I'm, you know. And so it was the exact same principles, but very different practices. So just to say them real quick, those principles are disturb the soil as little as possible, keep green living, number one. Keep green living plants in the ground as often as possible. Number three, keep a diversity of plants in the ground as often as possible. Number four, cover your soil. And number five, incorporate animals.
Well, all right. So, well, to this point then, so for folks that are interested in learning more about this, I know one of the things that that you guys offer at Singing Frog Farms, I think you mentioned this back in the income section, is you do offer workshops where people can come and actually, you know, they might have some of the, you know, the book knowledge or even the science knowledge, but they haven't actually rolled up their sleeves and, you know, gotten dirty actually applying this. And you give them the opportunity to do that, correct?
Yeah. So we do a very intensive 7-hour day where we do some discussions and walking around the farm looking at these principles and how we're managing them and examples. And then, yes, we dig in, we transition over a bed, we do some seeding in the nursery, we get our hands in the compost.
But we also have a lot of fun. Plenty of farmers come out who already have a lot of physical experiential practice, but they're missing the science background and therefore how to transition their farming over to a soil beneficial farming process through no-till, et cetera. So really it can be whether you are just the academic coming in or the farmer, both groups work well to see this marriage of the knowledge and experiential coming together.
Oh, that's great. So just real quick, because I'm sure this is catching the attention of a number of listeners here. When are your next workshops that you're offering?
They're advertised through Eventbrite, so you can find them pretty easily there. And I'll give you the link to share. March 5th, March 20th, and April 9th are our next workshops.
Okay, and then we'll follow that up with 2 or 3 workshops in the fall as well. So every spring and fall, we do a handful.
All right. So spring and fall, you've got a selection of ones that folks can go to. I do want to just give a quick commercial again for the next Peak Prosperity annual seminar, which is happening the last weekend in April of 2019 here in Sebastopol. That's the 26th through the 28th of April. Not only will the Kaisers come speak, but on the afternoon of Sunday, the 28th, we're going to be offering some private tours of their farm by Paul and Elizabeth. So if you want to come see this for yourself, that's another great opportunity to do so. But if you're somebody who thinks you really want to apply this in your life, definitely get the more hands-on experience and go check out one of their spring or fall seminars. All right. And then lastly, let's move on to the resilient farmer element.
You know,
very important.
Out there,
self-care.
And a lot of the farmers that we see, they're gung-ho and jumping into it when they're younger. And you're at it for 60, 80 hours a week, and that's just not sustainable. And so self-care is a very important way of, very important in all of that. And that might mean having a larger team so that you can flex different tasks. That might mean finding crops that are of higher value. I actually just had a wonderful discussion with a couple that started farming in their late 50s, and they said, we can't do market gardening, and we knew that. So we're growing saffron. And I thought that was great, and they're doing awesome. And so you need to figure out how you're going to take care of yourself in the whole system as well, because if you break, your system isn't going to
work. Well, again, making a parallel to peak prosperity. So among our eight forms of capital is emotional capital. And, you know, if you're the type of person that can't deal with adversity, kind of the rest of your preparations don't matter if your mind's not in the game.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So, you know, definitely sort of finding your niche, right? So I actually really like the saffron example and recruiting a good team. What are some of the other, you know, practices that can be helpful to folks that are, you know, challenged as they're trying to do this?
Well, just knowing when you need to take a break and how you are going to refuel yourself. And that might be going to Zumba twice a week, or that might mean, I have some friends who are no-till farmers, and they say, yeah, we know we could farm year round, but we need to take a break and of 2 months off of farming and, you know, go to Baja California or, you know, something like that. For us, we have built up such a wonderful team that we take vacations, and vacations are very important. And I just this morning did a sit down of planning of who's taking which vacation when, so that each of our farm crew can take a chunk of vacation, and yet we can make sure to get all of the tasks covered.
Right.
So for that, for us, that's very important.
Which is why possibly one of our biggest challenges is simply just managing people.
Yes.
And it's a fun challenge. It's great, but it means that if we have a big family of people taking care of our farm, then we can all take vacations whenever we want, as long as we coordinate to make sure we all keep that farm running in our individual absences.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been here in Sonoma County long enough to see folks that really jumped gung-ho into the farming thing. And, you know, having a farm, you know, it's a lot like having an infant. Right, where it just needs constant care every day, right?
That
kid's got to be fed and protected every day. You can't take a day off, right? And, you know, you jump in with enthusiasm. And if you're younger, you've got that youthful energy. But after, you know, 5-6 years, if it's still just, you know, you or you and a spouse doing this, you know, it's a treadmill that never ends. And so you can easily get burned out. So to your point, you know, you've got to figure out ways to either give yourself seasonal times to rejuvenate, or to, you know, become financially successful enough that you can hire a couple of people to give that balance that Paul was just mentioning of, okay, well, we'll take some time off here. You take some time off there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how about organizations like Granges and things like that? I mean, are they good sources of, you know, not only information and whatnot, but moral support, or you come help me at my farm and I can come help you at your farm? I mean, are there organizations out there that can help with this sort of support and self-care?
It's definitely important to have a sense of community. You want to have the community with your customer base, for sure. But that's a business orientation for our community. And it's wonderful. We love it. We totally believe in it. It keeps us going. It is also really nice to have a community with other growers and other food distributors and other people on that side of the business model. So it's wonderful to have the Grange just for a sense of meeting up with our farmers, sharing information, just having that community. And that really feeds you as well.
However you do it, if it's a Grange, we've also got a very strong farmer guild movement out here, where there's, you know, once a month potlucks and people get together and chat. And often it just happens casually, be it at the farmer's market, sharing information. We were just had a farmer friend over yesterday, and where are you getting your tool right now? And how are you doing this? And are you taking a break? And, you know, those sorts of discussions. And my brother, who is an aeronautical engineer, sometimes is shocked when I share with him how much information I share with the fellow farmers,
i.e.
our competitors in our area. And he's like, wow, you let them come on your farm? We would never let somebody else come into our workspace. And, you know, they might learn what we're doing. But amazingly, with farming, there is that culture sometimes of sharing. And we actually often get questioned. We do so much education. A lot of people who come through and or our employees end up starting farms in Sonoma County. So we actually have three of our employees from this year of 2018 who are starting their own farms in Sonoma County, and now they're going to be our competitors. And people say, wait, isn't this a bad business? You're creating your own competition. But we actually find it doesn't seem to be an issue because people end up finding their own niches and a rising tide floats all boats.
Right. We've been training our competition for many years, not just this year.
No.
And it has been a great thing. It just creates more awareness of good, healthy food and more awareness of good, healthy soil management and food production. And so you just get a larger community understanding and support and resiliency by having more farmers do what we're doing, even though they're right in our community at the very same farmers markets that we're in. So it's just been wonderful. Honestly, it creates much more resiliency and much more capacity that we can feed into them.
I'd actually like to transition into something that Paul and I have been saying for a long time. We often, especially in the early years of talking about our success, have been asked, well, this works great for you. Now grow it, you know, because that's how our economy is. Right. And for us, the way that we want to grow is not by growing in acreage. Necessarily, we believe that it's much more important to have more smaller farmers rather than a few very large farmers. And there's actually been some really wonderful putting together of data that is known in certain circles, especially internationally. But there was a publication that I really liked. It's put out by a group called the ETC Group that really looks at, you know, the industrial food chain versus small shareholders. And it's wonderful to find out that globally, we don't see this so much in the United States, but globally, 70% of the food produced is produced by small shareholders, not the industrial food chain of, you know, monocrop farms.
Yeah. And yet those small shareholders use 20% of all the resources to produce food, whereas the industrial production uses up 80% of agriculture's resources to make 30% of the food.
I mean, how damning is that of the inefficiency of
So it comes down to for every one energy caloric energy unit you put into the industrial ag, you get back 1.5 units of energy and food. Well, for the small shareholders, you put in one calorie of energy and you get back 15 calories of energy.
Isn't that just huge?
So that's your ROI is 1,500% there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, just crazy. I'm so glad that you highlighted that, Elizabeth. I think that's a great way to kind of bring the conversation here to a close, which is, you know, I used to be a part owner in a meat CSA down in Petaluma a few years ago. And what I always used to tell people as we'd give our farm tours is you know, look, I'm pretty agnostic as to, you know, whether you subscribe to my CSA or not. I'd love for you to do so, obviously. But the key thing is, to have this awareness of these better models, right? That are better for the land. They're better for our bodies. They're better for our palates. The food tastes better. And they're better for our local economies, right? You hire more people with smaller operations like this than you do on a big monocrop farm,
right?
Where you have huge economies of scale, but you have all the other sort of inefficiencies and deficiencies you talked about. And so, you know, people would come up from the city and they would, you know, they'd love the experience walking around the farm and seeing the cows and, you know, eating the food and all that stuff. And we just sort of complain that, you know, wow, how come this isn't done, you know, this way everywhere? And, you know, my answer to them as well, you know, the models that we get are going to be the models that we support. And so you may not really think about it so much when you're buying, you know, a pound of ground beef or you're buying some, you know, cauliflower or whatnot, but every dollar that you spend is a vote. And you're voting for which models that you want to see more of.
Exactly.
And so I think that, you know, for everybody who's listening to this, and is, you know, inspired by this and would love to, you know, work with providers in their area that grow this way or whatnot, you know, vote with your dollars, you know, rather than go to the big grocery store. This is the type of model you want to see. Find people that are doing this or doing what's as close to this as possible in your area. And support that with your dollars. It's the only way that this is going to grow in the long run.
Yeah. And also with working with smaller farmers, you actually get to have a dialogue.
Exactly.
Right.
Why do you do tillage? Or, you know, whatever you want to bring to the table there.
Yes.
All right. Well, Paul and Elizabeth, I want to thank you again. It's been another fantastic conversation. For everybody listening, if you want to learn more about the Kaisers and about their approach, their website for their farm is singingfrogsfarm.com.
You got it.
Great. And I presume on there, you mentioned it was on Eventbrite too, but I presume on your site, you've got information about the workshops for folks that want to go there.
We do.
Excellent. And if you want to meet the Kaisers in person, please come to the Peak Prosperity Seminar the last weekend in April of 2019. Again, you'll get a chance to hear from them again in a bit more detail, to walk their farm, but actually just get to talk with them in person. As you can tell, I'm sure, just from hearing them audio-wise, they're fantastic people, very warm-hearted and very approachable. With that, guys, I will see you in April.
Fantastic. Excellent. We're looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right, guys.